Okay, great. So I'm going to talk to you today about something that's different than anything I've ever talked about before. And there won't be any magnetic fields or conduction or, you know, it, to the extent that I can get away with not mentioning these things. And I'd really like to highlight that all the simulations have been performed by my student, Mike McCourt, that Elliot and I are co-supervising, and Pratik Sharma is doing a lot of really nice work on this project. And so it's the Berkeley Group is someone who's named us. So. All right, so I have to start with the pretty pictures from the observations. So the first is the lovely image of Perseus A, where this is zoomed in on the H-alpha filaments here in NGC 1275. So we see evidence of cool gas. We see that it has some sort of structure. You know, so this is, you know, the poster child of the cool gas. But there's a lot of other evidence as well. And so there's been this really nice study lately trying to get at the amount of cool gas in galaxy clusters done by Mike McDonald. And he's been doing this with an instrument he calls the MMTF, which is the Maryland Magellan Tunable Filter. Thank God I managed to get that out. And so it's a really nice systematic study of trying to look at some sort of sample of clusters and find out when they have H-alpha, when they don't have H-alpha. And H-alpha is our sort of catch-all proxy for sort of cool or cooling gas. And so in some clusters, like ABLE0496, so let me orient you to these plots here. So the left image is a red continuum. The next most image is an X-ray image, which is from Chandra, and it's been unsharp masked. The size of this bar right here is 20 kiloparsecs in every case. And then you zoom in, and you can look at the H-alpha map taken from this filter. And you can see extended filamentary structure. I don't know if the contrast is amazing on this screen. And then they also have some UV measurements, either from Galax, near UV measurements, either from Galax or from XMM. So you see systems where there's some sort of extended filamentary structure. You also see systems where the H-alpha has some sort of nuclear structure, but there's no evidence of filaments. So there's cooling gas, but it doesn't have the same sort of multi-phase structure that you see in the other systems. And then there's systems where you don't get any sort of H-alpha detection. So he's gone and he's done this nice systematic study, and I want to say there's maybe 20 or 30 clusters in a sample. And he has a new paper on groups, looking at the dependence of H-alpha on environment. And I haven't read that in detail enough to discuss it, but this is interesting work.
Are those clusters selected according to one particular criteria?
You know, I don't actually know what his selection criteria is. So I don't think it's, I think it's a rather heterogeneous sample.
We have not figured out what his selection criteria is. The sample is a little bit.
So, you know, I'm not going to claim any statistics from the sample. It's just to motivate where we're going.
You can't say anything
so.
About statistics.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the physics here. And so what we're actually doing in our simulation, so I'm a numericist, of course we're going to do some simulations, is we're solving the equations of hydrodynamics. And in addition, we have a model for heating and cooling. So where this is just the entropy equation, if Dick Bond were here, I would say this is the real entropy, where we have a term for the heating minus the cooling. And let's sort of summarize what the observations tell us. So first, there is no evidence for a classical cooling flow. You know, there's not these whopping 1,000 solar mass you know, cooling observations that were predicted for many years by Andy and crew. So what this implies is that we know that this heating function is not zero or incredibly less than the cooling function. So I'm just going to make some really simple stories here, and hopefully these are things that everyone will buy. But second, there is evidence of cool gas and gas that's cooling. And in this case, there's a plethora of evidence, including from some people in the room. Megan's done some very nice work here. There's H-alpha, there's CO, there's other molecular lines and atomic lines. You can see gas actually cooling through some of the iron and oxygen lines. There's even dust. Wow, that's crazy. So this tells us that these terms are not in perfect equilibrium everywhere, you know, at every position. So what else do we know? Well, I think we know the cooling function pretty well. So it's just Bremsstrahlung's plus lines, and we know it as a function of density and temperature. So I think this is something we really know. And I think, to be quite honest, we have absolutely no idea what the heating function is. And so, you know, that's future work. And so what I would say is that, you know, if you sort of take all of this all together, is that clusters are globally thermally stable. What I mean by this, global stability, is that they have some sort of, you know, consistent temperature profile. And I'm really thinking of cool core clusters here. you know, where there's something where heating is balancing cooling on average, but it's not at every single point, so that you can have local thermal instability that allows you to create these filaments and other structures.
The problem with cooling is usually assumed to be equilibrium. Is there uncertainty in non-equilibrium?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I'm not the expert on this, but I think it's in LTE, you know, especially because it's optically thin. I think the cooling is pretty simple. So I don't know, maybe someone's more expert on this than me.
Also true with like 1 kV.
Yeah, I think so. I think the lines are pretty well known here. So I don't think there's a lot of uncertainty.
It's not the knowledge of lines, it's the thermal state of the lines.
Well, if you're evaporating a cloud or something, maybe there's some transient things that you have to worry about.
But it's all quite well ionized and.
But you
and
the
stuff when you're trying to predict what's happening at 100,000 Kelvin or
yeah, down there.
Kelvin, yeah, no, especially down, million, sure. Then yeah, you'd have to begin to non-equilibrium effects. But at 10 to the 7, you're probably.
Yeah, close. I think we're pretty safe. Yeah.
I think you just made a statement that we see stuff cooling down. We see cool stuff, right? It could be deposited at this temperature.
Well, I think it's unlikely, because you see it, you know, in the RGS spectral work that Jeremy Sanders and Andy have done.
Species from a range of temperatures.
And the cooling time is so short at these.
It could be because cold gas is currently heated, so going the other way.
I mean, we're talking cold gas, it's, you know, factor.
I'm just shooting. Saying there is that, okay, I'm not saying this is wrong, I'm just saying, is there any other possibility, or is it the only one that we have?
Gas that's less.
If you deposit it from a galaxy, you strip it in the center, and then some heating mechanism
might
sort of
work. It's still 10 to 7 plus Kelvin. So
you'd have to heat it up a lot. So I think this is the simplest picture.
The coolest gas.
Gosh, I thought everyone would agree on this slide.
But the iron stuff, the oxygen 780 stuff, it's hard.
I know. Okay, let me move on just a little bit so I can get to the interesting part of the discussion. Okay, so this is where it gets really crazy, where you will certainly not agree with me, at least initially. And I'm going to make this absolutely crazy ansatz right now. And then I'm going to try to show that this isn't such a ridiculous idea as we move further on. So this is our simulation domain here. So I'm just going to show you some 2D linear boxes. So we've done all of this in galaxy cluster models, but I feel like it's much easier to get the physics across in these nice plane parallel atmospheres. And so gravity is obviously pointing down, and this is the scale height, and you know, it's vertically stratified. And so what we're going to do to try to get around this problem that we don't know what the heating mechanism is, we're just going to take a box here. We're going to add up all the cooling luminosity. We're going to take the average of it, and we're going to dump that right back into heating in this box. So, and this is constant heating per unit volume. Or we can do something, you know, slightly, you know, maybe more sophisticated, maybe not, depending on what you think the model is for how things get heating. We can weight it by density and do constant heating per unit mass. And what does this give you? Well, this gives you a globally thermally stable model. Which in some case may or may not have local density. And you're saying, well, you've just done something crazy by construction. So hopefully I'll try to convince you that this isn't actually as ridiculous as it seems. So, but just let's just play this game for now. And I'm doing this because we have absolutely no, you know, the first time we talked about this at group at Berkeley, I said this was nonsense. So, but come around. All right, so the next slide is going to have a little bit of math. So I'm going to tell you a couple time scales first. So the first time scale you want to keep in mind is the cooling time scale. And the cooling time scale is pretty simple. So, you know, relative to some gamma factors, it's basically the thermal energy in the gas divided by the cooling rate here, where lambda of t is we're just parameterizing the temperature dependence of the cooling function. And for pure Bremsstrahlung, it has a very simple dependence. The other time scale that's interesting in this problem is the free fall time, where this is just the scale height and this is just gravity. So I think everyone's probably on the same page with me. And I'm going to argue that these are two of the most important timescales for trying to figure out what's going on in these systems. So now let me define something which is basically a term I'm going to call theta, which is the imbalance in cooling and heating. And so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about, you know, sort of classical thermal instability. This is a la field. There's absolutely nothing new on this slide. And we'll assume that the heating is some sort of function of density to some power alpha. So you're locally thermally unstable when the derivative of this heating, cooling minus heating with respect to temperature is less than zero. So let me just say that really simple, right? You start to cool down, the cooling function goes up faster than the heating function goes up. That's all that the statement is saying. So this is local thermal instability, and it has a growth rate which has been known since, I don't know, when was Field, 1950s or something? Yeah, I forget what year it is. It has a very simple growth rate, you know, which, and the full generality depends on the derivative of the cooling function and the heating parameter. But it's actually very simple. You can just relate it. It's roughly grows on the cooling time. And this is specialized to the case of Bremsstrahlen.
So is that alpha the same alpha than the heating?
This is the alpha from here, yeah. So basically, if you have heating that's constant per unit volume or constant per unit mass, it doesn't do the job. So now you've got to come up with some sort of, you know, basically because Bremsstrahlen is going like n squared, and this is, you know, going like n to the 0 or n to the 1. The heating depends dramatically on what you think is doing the heating, whether it's cosmic rays or Alphane waves or turbulence that thermalizes. And you'll see that I think it's more important where the heating is rather than this power. And I'll come to this point a little bit later. And so the thing we find is when we've taken this very simple system with these very simple time scales, and we find that there's multi-phase structure when the cooling time is, I don't even know if I really mean much less than the free fall time. The cooling time is a little bit less than the free fall time. And this is pretty easy to see. Basically, the reason that this happens is that, you know, if the cooling time is short compared to the free fall time, you have time for blobs to cool, and as they cool, they exhibit multi-phase structure. Well, otherwise, if the free fall time is short, you don't have enough time to exhibit multi-phase structure. So let me show this with some movies now. So, and these are the two time scales, the cooling time and the free fall time. So I'm telling a fairly simple story.
Free fall is important here. I mean, do you assume that these clouds are self-gravitating? Why not some frozen time?
So in the simplest picture, they're not self-gravitating. So this is the free fall time for the atmosphere, the background atmosphere. Well, I'll show you. So, you can do this slightly more formally, and we have dispersion relations that include the free fall time. Well, no, I really mean free fall time because that's what's important here. It's probably quite similar to the sound crossing.
So why is it important for certain dynamics?
So think of it in this case. What happens is you form a dense blob and it just starts to fall. So it's just how long basically. You lose pressure support, you know, if it gets dense enough, it just looks like a rock.
But what matters there is some constant time, because it defines how quickly it is able to respond to the changes in the environment.
Yeah, so the sound crossing time is quite quick here. So everything's in pressure equilibrium.
Kind of steady equilibrium, right? So those two are the same.
Yeah, right. So they're really, I think we may be saying the same thing. Because they're
for the clock, that's quick.
I think he's talking about the free fall time in that.
I'm talking about the free fall time in the atmosphere, so it has nothing to do with the dense blob collapsing.
Itself, but I don't understand why it matters.
Well, I'll show you why it matters.
It is equal to the sound crossing time.
Tell me. Show me. It's a simple question. Why does free fall time matter?
You need it in some kind of absolute time scale to compare against in the air cooling time.
No, it has to be a relevant time scale, physical time scale.
Right, yeah. So
if it falls faster than it cools, it can't.
So it tells you, right? So imagine you have a density perturbation where you have something that's higher. It's going to start falling, right? Because it's denser than its surroundings. So this just tells you whether it falls faster than it cools or whether it cools faster than it falls.
It gives you roughly rate of adiabatic heating.
So why doesn't it matter how fast the clump can respond?
This is the clump being compaction.
So that's local thermal instability. Let me show some movies and then maybe ask this question again later, if it still doesn't.
You just needed to answer that question, but okay.
Okay, well, I've made an attempt, so I'm not sure I have too many more ways to explain it qualitatively. So all right. Yeah. So let's
read all Striker 77.
It's the same
argument.
Well,
that's cooling time.
Cooling time versus cooling. Yeah, but that's halo cooling as itself. Here, it's a clump cooling within the halo. It's a different physical problem.
But I think it's a question of what is.
I think it's similar.
You literally mean the dynamic. Well,
I don't mean the dynamical time in the blob or anything like that.
The crossing time of this patch. You haven't told us what the scale of this patch is. I'm interpreting it as if you're going to basically take this to the core and you're going to come out with a time scale of the gravitational time scale of Russell time for 10 to 8, 10 to 8 years, because you're going to be working at 10. You're going to put some numbers on this at some point. And
yeah, so I'll put this in cluster systems towards the end.
So suppose you consider Schwarzschild convection.
I'm gonna come to this.
Convective instability is developed. There's no free fall time there.
All right, I'm gonna.
Time and there is void.
I will come to this. I promise I'll come to this.
So there's no free fall, and it's problem that's not so difficult.
Oh, sure, but let me come to that at the end of the talk, because there's a lot of sort of misleading literature on this topic, which I think we've addressed mathematically. Let me come to it, Andre. Time out and let me come back to that. So.
Lay down, Landau. Are you going to tell me that Landau Lifshitz is
missing?
Okay. All right. So let me just show you some very simple movies in which, in this case, we're going to go with a short cooling time. The cooling time is short compared to the free fall time. Gravity's pointing down. We have a few vertical scale heights, and we're just going to let this evolve for a number of thermal instability times. And you see that clumps start to form, and you eventually see blobs starting to rain down, and we clearly get multi-phase structure. Whereas now, if we move to the opposite limit, where the cooling time is long compared to the free fall time, so those blobs had time to condense and then fall. In this case, these blobs have no time to condense before they fall. And you see that there's some sort of net cooling going on. There is a mass flux through our system. It gets a little bit turbulent, but you're not seeing any evidence of multi-phase structure. And so if I put up sort of a rogues gallery of this, as we vary the free fall time versus the cooling time, so these are the simulations I showed you, and you can either start with isothermal initial conditions, or in this case, you know, the entropy is stratified, or you can start with isentropic ignition conditions, and we do heating per unit volume or heating per unit mass, and it all gives qualitatively almost the exact same thing.
Stably stratified according to Schwarzschild?
So if it's isothermal, it's stably stratified according to Schwarzschild.
And no magnetic fields?
No, this is pure hydrodynamics. I told you I wasn't going to say that word. So.
Why is it important that clumps fall somewhere? Thermal stability can exist with all these clumps going anywhere.
Sure, but we're interested in thermal instability in a stratified medium.
So why? I mean, you can form clumps and they wouldn't go anywhere. So why free fall time is important?
Well, because if they get denser than their backgrounds, so this is just buoyancy. They start to sink.
This is Riesz-Ostreicher, right? So this is whether you can. Because you know the Riesz-Ostreicher is basically, can you fragment, right? And you know you can fragment if you can radiate energy faster than adiabatic heating supplies it, and then you can go to higher and higher densities.
Well, the reason I'm striking is just essentially a cooling flow problem in the paper. It's cooling time of the cooling flow, whether you develop cooling flow or not, and stratify something.
No, you will still develop a cooling flow even if your cooling time is longer than the free fall time. You just won't fragment.
Can I ask, is this actually sustained, the turbulence?
Well, it is reasonably sustained. This doesn't generate huge turbulence, right, in this case. I don't think we've actually quantified the turbulence.
Very long yet?
So in this case, we've run it a few cooling times until basically, because the cooling time is very different as a function of height, because these are stratified atmospheres. And so we turned these simulations off when it started to cool a bit at the top of the box, because we don't want the boundary conditions.
Okay, what are your boundary conditions?
They're inflow, and actually, so really what we've done is there's another half of the simulation down here, so it's completely symmetric above the midpoint. And we've just cut that off, and actually gravity points towards the midpoint. This way we don't have any sort of funny boundary condition at the very center. So these are just our simple boxes. We have nice cluster models which are spherically symmetric, and, you know. But I feel like this is easier to get the intuition.
So you would not be surprised if it actually became stationary in the end again.
Yeah, I think it's roughly well.
I mean, really without any motions.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, because, you know, you can imagine this being a steady state process where more gas falls in and cools and other mass, the dense clumps then fall at the bottom of the box.
But you get the energy for the turbulence, what drives the turbulence?
Well, I mean, you know, basically you're tapping into the gravitational potential energy just a little bit here. So that's really what it is the dense blobs. So.
And if eventually you run into a new equilibrium, I would think, and then you can't tap anything anymore. Right?
Well, there's constantly new material falling in, and you know, if you think of a galaxy cluster,
you
know.
Simulating an infinitely big system.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just the inner part where the cooling time is short. When you move far enough out, you have an infinite, compared to the core, you have an infinite reservoir of both thermal energy and mass.
Yeah, You mentioned earlier that the heating function was actually given by the averaged
Yeah, so that's the case here. So otherwise, what happens if, I didn't show you a movie of this, but if you don't have this average cooling function, the whole atmosphere just faults. So
I still don't understand why free fall time matters. So here's the well, let me explain. It's important because it's a key here. So suppose I cool, right?
Yes.
So I cool a cloud, but now it can fall.
Yes.
But if it can respond, what matters here is whether it's buoyant or not, right? What determines whether it's buoyant or not? What determines is how quickly it can respond to the changes of conditions. If it can respond quick, it will adjust so that it's not buoyant anymore. It's not going to fall anywhere. So free fall time will be irrelevant. So I don't see how crossing time doesn't enter here.
You can,
no.
So there's no conduction here.
If there's no conduction, how would it respond?
Well, by compressing, increasing the...
So there's some old literature by Balbus and Soker where they argue that there's really an overstability. Where, so these are just buoyantly, you know, it's an overstability is that as it starts to cool and then it returns to its equilibrium position, it returns with a higher amplitude than it did before. And they make this argument which does not apply here, I think. I'll get to it later at the very end, actually, because it's...
Why can't you answer? Why crossing time doesn't end?
Crossing time is the same thing as the free fall time.
Well, crossing time is a clump. That's
okay. Suppose the crossing time across the clump is extremely short, so it's always in pressure equilibrium, right? Then the free fall time tells you how quickly the surroundings do PdV work on the clump, right? So if the clump falls quickly, then the PV work is done quickly. If it falls slowly, then PV work is injected slowly. So if you compare that against the cooling time, so if the cooling time is short, then it radiates all the energy away that the surroundings do on it. But if the cooling time is long, then the PV work done on the clump can bring it to equilibrium and it won't radiate that energy away.
And why doesn't the response time doesn't matter?
You can assume that response time is infinitely short.
Okay, good.
If I thought about writing down the local dispersion relation, if I did a local walk down the clock, what is the balancing term that you're talking about? It's not a term like CSK, it says involving the points.
I mean, no, it actually looks pretty much just exactly like the field criterion almost, so. I can show it to you.
Way stern turbulence, but what is it? What's the...
Sorry, say that again?
In the limit way stern turbulence.
There's not much turbulence, so the turbulence really makes no difference here.
A few slides ago you wrote down the driving for the instability, you wrote down the growth time.
Yeah, that is the growth time.
But what's the other term? You're saying something like involves a free fall time.
So this is whether you get multi-phase structure or not. In both cases, it's still locally thermally unstable. So...
I mean, how well is that actually established that you really have an thermal instability?
Oh, we have all the we'll put a paper out in a week or two that has all the mathematics in it. So we've done the formal dispersion relations.
Because in the galactic context, you have galactic thermal instability only at lower temperatures, below and around 10 to the 4th Kelvin.
Yeah, so now you're on a different part of the cooling curve. So you're way at, you know, I mean, you can think of you're at a different part of the thermal instability cooling curve. Okay, so let me try and connect this. Hopefully I've provided some sort of qualitative understanding of what's going on. Maybe not quantitative yet. And let me try to connect this to some of the multi-phase structure here. So one thing we find is we find that density perturbations are a strong function of gravity. So what I'm plotting here is this is the RMS density perturbations in our simulations versus the thermal instability time over the free fall time. And so this is shown for one particular set of, so these curves are either isentropic or isothermal atmospheres or volume heating or mass heating. So, you know, I'm just trying to show that this is fairly general. And if I put the rest of the curves back on the plot, you see that everything is the same trend. So the simulations I've been showing you are all in 2D, but we've done 3D simulations that largely track these values. And we really feel like everything is converged. So these are... We have quite a lot of resolution in these, so the 3D simulations are rather expensive. The other thing you find is if you take a look at the cold fraction, so if we set something that's, you know, I think in this case we set our boundary at the initial temperature divided by 3 or something like that, how much mass has moved into the cold phase, you find that that's also a very strong function of the thermal instability time versus the free fall time. And that at times, so this is again the case where you're getting multi-phase structure, where you really have a lot of separate cold blobs that are falling out. Otherwise, you have sort of a mixed cold and hot blobs that are all falling together. You might say, well, why don't you just wait a few more cooling times, and then eventually you'll get some cold material over here. And that's not actually true. So in the weak cooling limit over here, you won't actually develop any cold phase. So, because all of our simulations are run for multiple thermal instability times. And so I'm going to show a little bit on the mass accretion rate. And so here, this is a little confusing when you do this in the plane parallel geometry, because the cooling flow is actually quite different in plane parallel versus in a spherically symmetric system, because there's this big adiabatic compression as the blob moves in. So I'll actually, don't stress too much about this, because we actually get moments of outflow as well. That's what these thick solid lines are, so that we could put this on a log plot. But you actually find that when the thermal instability time is long, you actually get rather large suppressions of the actual m dot towards the inner part of our simulation versus the m dot you would get from a cooling flip.
So your heating function is insensitive to m dot.
Yeah, in this case, it's completely insensitive to m dot. So that's why I said this is a crazy ansatz. So this is a way for us to, in reality, I think the heating function really is a function of m dot. And we have some simulations, which I'm not going to show today, where we do that. But let me show you this in the cluster context, because I think this is more interesting. So, and this is hot off the presses from the second paper we're writing on this. And so Pratik just sent me this plot today. And so this is the suppression of the mass accretion rate. And so let me tell you, we're using this the entropy models that Megan and Mark have proposed, where you have a central entropy with this rise. And I think we talked about this morning. And so these curves on the left, this is the actual m dot. If heating is sort of roughly balancing cooling. And in this case, we do it in spherical shells. And in this case, there's no heating, and this is the pure cooling flow. And these are the different values of the initial entropy. So let's look at 30, which is the green one. Sorry if anyone's colorblind. So this is the green one right here. And we find that in this case, we're getting sort of somewhere between 0.1 and 1 solar masses of cooling flow, or of actual material cooling in through the inner boundary of the simulation, which we set at 1 kiloparsec. Whereas the actual cooling flow solution, you're rapidly up around 10 to 100 to 1,000, and it's very episodic. You know, I mean, this, the actual spikes here are kind of junk, right? Because cooling flows are sort of nonsense. But we find that the cooling is both episodic and actually quite suppressed by a factor of 100 to 1,000 from the m dots that we would expect. So now let me just say a word of caveat. We have not solved the cooling flow problem, right? Because this is some crazy heating ansatz.
What was the balance again? Was this?
It says heating is balancing cooling and radial and
globally.
They're not globally in a shell.
So this is locally in shells, so this is not global. We also have models, which I'm not going to show today, where we've done epsilon m dot.
Is it heating? Is it density dependent? Or?
We do it both ways. We've done it both ways. We've done it per unit.
The curves, do they look similar? Or?
Yeah, they look very similar.
So it doesn't matter how the heating is case the density?
No, as long as it's locally thermally unstable, there's not much difference. So, we still have a few simulations we've been running, so we're trying to parcel the final results, which is why I'm not going to show you some of the results. But we also have models where we do a more realistic heating.
Is there something significant about the time scale for the bumps, or is that just?
I don't think so. We also have a model where we do epsilon m dot c squared heating, so where we actually calculate the mass accretion rate, and then we put in a real heating that corresponds to the mass, you know, thinking that eventually this is getting accreted by a black hole, which then does some sort of heating. And there you really have to decide what the shape of the heating function is in radius. And that's the part that we have no idea. And just to show you that this is not such a ridiculous idea, we go back to this original model. So this is our fiducial case I showed you. Where I showed you this movie earlier, where there's no multi-phase structure and multi-phase structure. But now we take this heating model and we perturb it a lot. So we actually add white noise perturbations that have a delta correlate, have a white noise power spectrum and is time correlated with the thermal instability time. And so we put in fluctuation amplitudes of 100% and we still get multi-phase structure. If you go to 300% fluctuations, our predictions start to break down. But this is to show that this careful height by height balancing is not, you know, it's more robust than you might initially think. And actually, this is what surprised me, and it was this plot that really convinced me that we weren't doing something totally ridiculous. Okay, so let me try and connect to data a little bit now.
How much do the m dots vary if you change the fluctuation power?
That's a good question. I don't know if we've looked at that. So.
I'm sorry, how is that implemented? I mean, is that stochastic in time, or what is the delta?
So delta, yeah, so we actually do this with, we have an autocorrelation function such that delta is white noise, but the correlation in spatial scales, and in time, it's correlated with thermal instability time. So we actually try and be somewhat sophisticated about it, because you know, the thought is the heating isn't going to change on a time scale faster than the thermal instability time, because you couldn't fuel it any faster. Okay, let me try to connect to data now. So what we've done is we've taken, you know, probably the most biased sample ever. And it's basically the union of clusters that are in the accept catalog and the ones that McDonald has done H alpha. So we have a Chandra archive limited sample and, you know, his own personal selection function limited sample. And we've taken the union of these. So this is the most biased sample you will probably ever encounter.
But with bias, who knows?
Yeah, but with bias, who knows? And what we've done is we've fit Monique's uniform pressure profile to these. And we, you know, so that we could derive cooling times and free fall times and, you know, and equilibrium. And then we've gone and we looked and we've seen what sort of H alpha measurements were made. And so let me take this and put this on a slightly different plot. What I'm plotting here is T cool over T free fall as a function of radius in these clusters. And you see that it's minimum somewhere around 10 kiloparsecs usually. And so if we look at the minimum now, and we plot this as the cooling time as the bottom axis here, and this axis is the cooling time versus the free fall time. So I'm trying to argue when you may or may not see multi-phase structure. And this suggests that there's some sort of critical value here. And so actually in our 3D simulations and real cluster geometries, we find that actually 8 is about the critical value. So there's actually a very good correlation between our real cluster
model. To do statistics.
So this is total nonsense, right? You know, in terms of, I've drawn this line suggestively.
You can't infer fraction of the population from this, but you can look for exceptions to a.
There's very little data here, right? So we're very data starved in this case, but it's consistent with what we thought, you know, in that it's not the cooling time itself or the central entropy that actually determines whether you get multi-phase structure. Or just H alpha or no H alpha.
It's just H alpha. That's just central point source type of H alpha.
Yes, so that's the one I showed you in the second line there in the middle. You know, where there's some sort of nuclear H alpha emission,
right.
But
so
not
AGN related.
Nothing with filamentary structure. Mm-hmm. But everything that has filaments is below this critical value. And you know, I'm not going to make any arguments that this is robust, but merely suggestive.
If you talk to Tommy Bell, he'll say, you know, this T cool over T free fall changes completely once you have turbulence.
Once you what?
Once you have turbulence.
That's the funny thing about the filaments, they're really straight long.
Yeah, so there must be magnetic filaments.
Well, I guess that's.
Yeah, so there's way more to this story than what I've, you know, than what we've initially outlined, but. So this was sort of our first attempt to take a stab at this. You know, let's say we can generate some sort of prescription that allows us to be globally stable, yet study local thermal instability. And I'm going to start to wrap up here. And I just want to compare to some of the previous work, because I think this may be a source of confusion. There's a lot of previous work out here on thermal instability in stably stratified media.
Very elegant.
Yeah, and there's some very nice work. And I think what it turns out is we've worked through it in our group is that I think it just doesn't apply to galaxy clusters. And so to start with is, you know, this great paper by Balbus and Soker, in which they claim that thermal instability requires convective instability in a stratified atmosphere. This might be what you're getting at, Andre.
I was just talking about the Schwarzschild criterion.
This is the Schwarzschild criterion.
Right.
So they claim that the only way you can have thermal instability or overstability in a stratified medium is if it's convectively unstable. They argued that there's no way for a stably stratified medium to be thermally unstable. You know, and when you go to the cluster data, I didn't show the plot, but there's, you know, just this beautiful, well, I guess we talked about this in coffee this morning, until you get to the really funny stuff in the outskirts, you know, it's pretty consistently DR is greater than zero. You know, and I don't really. Yeah, but it's generally a consistent picture. But here's what they assume. They assume that heating is this thermodynamic state function of the plasma, just like cooling. So cooling is purely a function of density and temperature. And here they assume that heating is purely a function of density and temperature. And in fact, if you make this assumption, you get this exact result. But what we've done in a paper, which we're going to post soon, is we've generalized this. So and this is where we get into the dispersion relation. So if heating is actually a function of position, then this claim is not actually true. Convectively stable atmospheres can be locally thermally unstable. So it, you know, if you just make this little generalization, and I think, you know, let's put this in the context of galaxy clusters, I think heating is going to be a strong function of position, right? If you start thinking about any of the ways that you might actually generate heating in these systems.
Is the vector hat over your RV equal? Meaning, can you just write a radial disturbance metric?
I think that's where the problem gets really hard. I think a lot of the heating functions are probably going to not be spherically symmetric.
Sure, but I mean, is it necessary in your proof or whatever?
So we've only done this radial. Actually, there's really no vector proof. So you know, we've only done this for the radial system because
spherical harmonics.
Oh my God! If you'd like to do the dispersion relation, someone better at Mathematica than me can do it.
To be fair, either 20 kiloparsec DS DR can be about zero.
Andre's point is absolutely right in that, you know, this could be pretty close to zero in the inner part. And so some of those models, actually, in fact, our fiducial model was isentropic, where it's an isentropic atmosphere, just in those local calculations.
Is turbulence, certain turbulence is a good suppressor because heating?
Is this mixing as well?
But it also can generate seeds for thermal stability because it's fluctuating.
Yeah, that's what happens in star formation.
Yeah, exactly. Star formation. So the heating mechanism.
So the star formation, the difference is supersonic, and here it's subsonic.
But you still generate over densities. It's just they're much weaker.
Right, but that's why it's in star formation, it's very, like, you've got already on the subsonic thermal, so you can, like, a short generate huge.
Okay, before we devolve into general conversation, let me just do one more comparison to work. So because this is a more recent paper by Benny on high-velocity clouds, which, to the best of my knowledge, largely repeats what Peng has pointed out to me was done by Malagarli, Rossner, and Bodo. I think this sort of gets rediscovered regularly. And they also make this exact same claim, that you can't have thermal instability in a convectively stable atmosphere, except they make a slightly different assumption. They assume that there's really no heating in the system, and that instead you're perturbing about a cooling flow solution. So, you know, they assume that the cooling completely dominates the heating and perturb about a cooling flow. And we know that there's no cooling flows. And they include conduction. I sort of promised I wasn't going to talk about conduction. But we have simulations with conduction in this case, which I didn't show because it just complicates things. But it's not globally thermally stable, and it's not locally thermally stable, right? It's very obvious it's not locally thermally stable, right? Because, you know, the temperature goes down, the cooling goes up, and the heat conduction goes down really fast. So, and you know, this basically just introduces a new length scale, and that conduction stabilizes cooling on scales below the field length, but on scales bigger than the field length, it does nothing for it. And so I would say that this doesn't apply to clusters because we're not in this cooling flow limit, you know, based on the evidence I outlined in that very first slide. So this isn't appropriate. Okay, so.
It's sort of ironic when he starts with the cooling flow solution.
Yeah, as much as he hated the cooling flow, it's kind of funny. But I don't think he realized he was in a cooling flow limit because he was thinking about high velocity clouds, really. Where there you're really thinking about more like balancing conduction and cooling. I don't really think he was thinking so much in the cluster context, or you know, and he doesn't say cooling flow either.
No,
so.
No, of course not.
So anyway, let me just summarize really quickly, and then then we can argue about T free fall. So I would say the galaxy clusters are globally thermally stable, but they're sometimes, and not always, locally thermally unstable. Well, they're probably always locally thermally unstable, but sometimes you get multi-phase structure. And sometimes you don't. I think we've come up with some sort of reasonable heating model, you know, which allows us to at least study these systems and provide some sort of intriguing hints. But it's certainly not the last word, because, you know, there's no physical motivation. You know, there's no physical process that actually, like jets or bubbles or MHD waves or what have it, that actually produces this heating function. And I think this is a ton of work to do to figure this part out. So anyways, that's all I was going to say.
This is 1% mass dropout efficiency. I think you mentioned that at some point you mentioned that you get that naturally.
Are you talking about the mass fluxes across the inner band? Yeah, so that just comes out naturally from this prescription.
So is there a way to understand how that happens? Is that the ratio of the free fall and cooling times?
It does have something to do with this, and that we have an analytic estimate for what this is in the linear case, actually. So, but I don't think I can reproduce it on the board right now. So
I know some history of people trying to do it in galaxies, in galactic halos, for high velocity flowers. Mm-hmm. The complications there are always the magnetic fields and conduction and so on. But suppose you as you say, you know, forget about those. But you can't forget about gauge and stability. So. The way these clouds will start moving down, right, they'll be cage unstable because they're moving through the medium. So I'll continue pestering you about time scale. So what about cage time scale? Why doesn't it enter?
Well, then you can't leave the magnetic field out.
Forget about magnetic field.
No, it's you not can't. Including them, right? You have a magnetized medium and the cloud falls in a magnetized medium.
Right.
And then you get magnetic breaking.
Right.
Which suppresses the cage.
But then you have to consider magnetic pressure as well.
Absolutely.
So he doesn't consider it. That's why that limit, you have to worry about cage instability. If you invoke magnetic field, you have to invoke everything else with it, right?
Yeah.
So just saying in that model, where there's no magnetic field and there's no conduction.
That's for the cage instability.
Yeah, we haven't considered the Kelvin-Humboldt instability, but probably why we don't see it really is these clumps are collapsing to our grid scale, basically. So, you know, because there's no conduction, so there's nothing to stop them from collapsing on a bigger scale.
But that should occur. That means that they can be disrupted faster than the.
So I'm not sure we have the resolution to see the Kelvin-Humboldt instability on these clumps. I'll say that first, but we probably could estimate. We haven't done it. It's a very good point to bring up,
so
actually.
Time scale is the length scale over the free fall velocity, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So, which is the point velocity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
in general, that's longer than the cooling time in these. I mean, it can be comparable. I don't know. It's all over the map, actually. So all these time scales, depending on where you are anything from 10 million years to giga years. So. So these timescales probably all interchange, you know, in their ordering. Even as blobs fall, they could change quite a bit in their ordering. But the thing is once you have a very dense clump, then the cooling time is very high, or very short.
I just saw that, for example, there's some simulations done by Fabian Feitsch and the, working with Mary Putman, where they tried to model high-velocity clouds,
mm-hmm.
but without magnetic gradient taken into account. But they see these clouds condensing, started to fall and disappear at the same time. So they don't
reach
the disk because they just cage and
disrupt. In fact, I think the cage
timescale
would be a quarter of the sound crossing time.
It's probably,
okay, fine.
I think it may be on a similar time scale. It could be in this case that these are dense enough that you don't, well, I don't know. You should be able to disrupt it with the cage and stability. And it may just be a resolution question. I don't know how robust or how not robust we are to the Kelvin-Humboldt instability. I mean, we don't see it at all in our simulations that we know of.
But you just said it collapses. You can cage on.
No, but I don't think it's
cell side loads.
We haven't necessarily resolved it, so.
There's no cage instability if you have a cube falling.
Well, these aren't necessarily a cube falling.
I think Andre is saying nothing works unless you have magnetic
shields. Yeah, right. So I mean, you know, no. But you know, right. So is it fair to turn into really focus on the cage and stability if we don't add all the other physics too? And so.
But you present a model which has physics assumptions. Within those physics assumptions, cage stability is a valid point. If you want to neglect that cage stability, you have to consider other effects of the related to magnetic fields, right? Mm-hmm. Or turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
So let's declare one.
Fair enough. I will not claim that we have a slam dunk. I think we just have a reasonable first attempt at this.
I want to understand that 1%.
Okay, let's talk afterwards. Because I tried to leave most math out of this. So.
This is the magic. No,
magic, it's circuit, right? It's so different from getting free. Thank you.